Lecture 4, Napoleon and the Beginnings of Egyptology.
Hello again. Remember in the first lecture where I said we're going to do it chronologically from the beginning towards the end with a few side trips? This is a side trip. What I'd like to talk about today is a military campaign, Napoleon's campaign in Egypt, and how it led to the beginning of modern Egyptology. Now, what I'll do is I'll explain the campaign. I'll explain why Bonaparte was going to Egypt. But I'll also explain why he took with him 150 scientists, artists, engineers. And then I'll try to show you what came out of this expedition, how modern Egyptology is really due to Napoleon Bonaparte. But first, why did he go to Egypt? Well, 1798 is the year that he took off. At this time, Napoleon isn't the emperor. Right? He's just a young general. He's 29 years old. And he's coming out of the Italian campaigns. He's done very well, marvelously. He is the hero. He has defeated an Italian army. He has conquered Italy, organized an army, and he's also brought back an awful lot of treasures to Paris. He has taken the artworks from Italy and brought them back to Paris. So he is the hero. He comes back to Paris, conquering hero, 29 years old, top of the world. And the directory, who is running the government, says to him, your next task is to invade England. Now, Bonaparte is infantry. He is not a sailor. So he doesn't want to do that, right? England is, of course, the enemy of France at this time. He looks at the boats and says, they're inadequate. We're not going to invade England, right? But he has another plan. He suggests, I'll go and conquer Egypt. Now, there's several reasons why conquering Egypt is a reasonable thing for Bonaparte to say. One is, politically, it was the worst thing you could do to England is conquer Egypt. Why? This was England's land route to India. English trade depended on controlling Egypt. And if the French controlled Egypt, English economy was dead. So he was going to strike a blow at England by going to Egypt. The other reason he wanted to go, I think, was personal. Alexander the Great was always his hero. And Alexander the Great began the great career of his by conquering Egypt. And he even said, you know, all greatness starts in the East. Right? So he wanted to conquer Egypt, I think, because Alexander the Great had done it. Now, also, I think he wanted to see the place. You know, he was a person like we are. He was also a scholar, by the way. Don't think of Napoleon, you know, as this crude guy. Not at all. He was a member of the French Institute in Mathematics. He was a bit of a culture vulture. Wherever he went, he would draw up lists of artworks to be requisitioned. Right? He was an okay guy. As a matter of fact, you know our system of numbering the streets, odd-numbered houses on one side, even-numbered on another? That was Napoleon's idea. He got lost one night, ticked off, he couldn't find a house. He said, we're going to number odd-numbered and even-numbered. But Napoleon was really somebody to be reckoned with. Right? So he was off to Egypt. The year is 1798. Now, what was known about Egypt in 1798? Not much. Hieroglyphs, right, hadn't been deciphered yet. Right? And remember, by the way, the word is hieroglyphs. The carvings you see on the walls are not hieroglyphics. That's an adjective, right? It's a hieroglyphic writing. It's a hieroglyphic script. But the ducks and birds are hieroglyphs. Hieroglyphs hadn't been deciphered. So a lot of the history was unknown. There was no systematic attempt at organizing the knowledge that was known. For example, there weren't museums with large collections of Egyptian antiquities. The closest thing to a museum collection was what were cabinets of curiosities. These were wealthy people in Europe had little cabinets, literally like a china closet, in their houses where they would have curiosities. It might be a mummy's arm brought back from Egypt by a sea captain. It might be a two-headed baby in a jar, right? These were the cabinets of curiosities that wealthy people, you would come, and after dinner, let me show you my cabinet, right? So this was as close to a museum collection as we had. So Bonaparte was sailing off into sort of uncharted waters. He was really doing something new. Now, also, the information that had been gained about Egypt came from unprofessional sources. What I mean by that is you get missionaries going to do missionary work, and they'd come back and report. They weren't trained observers. They had their own agendas. So you don't often get an objective reporting. Or sometimes it would be a sea captain who sailed up the Nile and would describe what he saw. In 1737, two sea captains went to Egypt. One by the name of Pocock, the other Norden. Norden was a Danish and Pocock was English. We don't know that they even talked to each other. They were in Egypt at the same time, and I figured out their ships probably crossed in the Nile. But each one wrote a description of Egypt. And what you get are kind of drawings that are unprofessional. I mean, Norden's looked like he never left the ship. They're little tiny pyramids across the water. I mean, almost like he never got off his boat. So you never had a really good description of this country, Egypt, that Napoleon was sailing for. Bonaparte was going to change all that. He took with him 150 artists, scientists, and it was an all-star team. Now, let me say this. It wasn't easy to recruit these guys. Why? His destination was a secret. When he sailed from France in 1798, he took 55,000 soldiers with him. Right? 55,000. And practically none of them knew where they were going. Incredible, but true. Only the captains, of course, of the ships, of the fleet, knew. He had kept it a secret, and many of the scientists didn't know where they were going. They were merely recruited for a great experience. So when they sailed, there was a lot of rumor. You know, some people thought, well, maybe we're going to the Holy Land, which was close. But nobody knew for sure. They started at Malta, by the way. They stopped along the way at Malta to conquer Malta, because Malta was strategically important. And great stories about what happened. Malta was controlled by the Knights of Malta. But they were an old, kind of rusty organization. They were old men who didn't really want to fight. And it took 2 days, and he was in control of Malta. He quickly took all the treasures of the Knights of Malta, right? Which included, by the way, life-size silver statues, 12 of them, of the apostles. They'd never been seen again. They disappeared. The only thing he left for the Knights was a splinter from the true cross. That's what he left them. But after Malta, he sailed for Egypt with his all-star crew. Now, let me tell you about some of these guys. Vivant Denon was probably the second oldest member of the group. They were young. He was in his 50s, Denon. But he was a professional artist and a friend of Bonaparte, and he's later going to become the first director of the Louvre, right? The first director of the museum when it's founded. First started out as Musée Napoléon, by the way. Denon went along as an artist, but there was also Berthollet, the chemist, right? And Napoleon had known him before, and he called him my chemist, right? So Berthollet was the chemist. He also took along with him guys like Geoffrey Saint-Hilaire, who was a great naturalist, young, up and coming. You know who was there? The mathematician, Fourier, as in the Fourier transformations. He was there. The mineralogist, Dolomieu, after whom we have the mineral dolomite named, he was there. There was Monge, who was a great mathematician. It was an amazing crew. Even Redoute, who was a brother of the famous Redoute who painted roses, right, to do the botanical drawings. He was going to describe all of Egypt. Now, along with these sort of senior scientists, and most of them were professors, came a younger crew of students. Now, these guys were professors at the École Polytechnique, for example. So they brought with them students. You know, hey, I'm going on. You're 19 years old. Come on. We're going. And you would have young students along. So many of the people there were like 17, 18. I mean, there's even one kid who took his books along. He was 17 years old when he left, took his books along, studied in Cairo, and the next year he was examined and he became an engineer. He was graduated in Cairo, right? So it was an exciting adventure for the savants. But there was a war to fight, right? Napoleon still had to conquer Egypt. So he leaves in 1798, conquers Malta, and then there's a war to fight. Now, he lands his man near Alexandria. All is well. But one of the things about this campaign that sort of reveals Bonaparte's personality, he was always impatient. I mean, he was a genius, and he was brilliant, but he was impatient. They landed in August, right? Summer. It's hot. They have woolen uniforms and no canteens. They had not prepared for a desert campaign. And the first thing they do when they march from Alexandria to Cairo, the desert road, they start dying of thirst. The locals had filled in the wells, right? So there were no water. Men shot themselves. They were in such agony, right? Now, Bonaparte, when he landed, was trying to explain to the people that I'm your friend. I'm not going to conquer. Now, understand the political situation in Egypt at the time. Egypt was not being ruled by the Egyptians, per se. The Turks had official control of Egypt. And the Turks had as their kind of janissaries, their emissaries in Egypt, the Mamluks. Now, Mamluk is a word that means bought man. The Mamluks were originally bought as slaves from the Circassian Mountains as young boys, and they were trained to be soldiers in Egypt. Eventually, they revolted. They became soldiers, revolted, and now the Mamluks were in charge. And they were tyrannizing the peasants, taxing them heavily. And Bonaparte lands, and he issues a proclamation to the Egyptians. We come here to free you. Now remember, this is just after the French Revolution. We're talking liberté, égalité, fraternité. And that's what he's preaching to these people. And he says, we're going to liberate you from the Turks. Right? Interesting, by the way, the very first document ever published in Arabic in Egypt was Napoleon's proclamation. He brought the printing presses, the first Arabic printing presses to Egypt. And where did he get the typeface? They raided the Vatican. They went to the Vatican, took all the typeface, brought it over with printing presses, with two printers, and they were set up to print. Right? So the first documents you get published in Arabic, Napoleon. But anyway, we got to get to the war. They march to Cairo. Eventually, they make it to Cairo. Men kill themselves. It's a terrible situation. And they are just about hanging on by their fingernails. And they are about to fight the battle of their lives, the Battle of the Pyramids. There are two major battles fought in Egypt, the Battle of the Pyramids and the Battle of the Nile. Neither one is accurate. They're both misnamed. The Battle of the Pyramids was not by the Pyramids, and the Battle of the Nile was not by the Nile. But we'll get to the Battle of the Nile in a minute. The Battle of the Pyramids was fought in a melon patch, about 6 or 7 miles from the pyramids, in a place now called Mbaba. There's a camel market there now. But you could see the pyramids in the distance. And the Mamluks had been massing their forces. So you were going to get a clash, for the first time in history, of a modern Western fighting army, Napoleon's, with an Eastern fighting force. But they were very, very different. The Mamluks were all cavalry. The typical Mamluk, and these were, I mean, really great-looking guys. They had turbans. They had flowing robes. They all had these wonderful horses. They all had two pistols, swords, and a servant or two running behind. So what they would do is they would go into battle with their horses, with their pistols, fire their pistols, throw them over their shoulders. The servants would grab them, reload them, find them in the battle, give them back their pistols, and it would all continue again. So we were going to get these very brave Mamluks, skilled horsemen, fighting Napoleon's disciplined army. A lot of these guys had been with him in Italy and knew it worked. They had never lost. Right? Napoleon had never lost a battle. So the Battle of the Pyramids is about to be fought. Napoleon has his men form squares. You have riflemen on the outside. You have artillery on the corners. And the cavalry is inside the square. The Mamluks are about to charge. Probably about, I mean, more than 5,000. We're not sure of the exact numbers because they get exaggerated, but certainly more than 5,000. Napoleon's squares are formed. And just before the battle, Napoleon points to the pyramids. You could see them in the distance. And he says, soldiers, from these heights, 40 centuries of history looks down upon you. Now, the remarkable thing is he was about right. The pyramids were about 40 centuries old. And you wonder how he knew it, because remember, it hadn't been studied yet. It was really an educated guess. And the battle began. It was quickly over. The Mamluks charged. And the squares held their fire until the Mamluks were right on top of them. And they just blew them away. The Mamluks retreated, massed again, another charge, and it was clear. They were no match for a Western army. The Mamluks were done with. Now, the army was quite happy about this, not just because they'd won the battle, but these Mamluks carried their wealth with them. They often had gold coins sewn into their turbans. So right after the battle, there was a tremendous amount of looting. You know, these Mamluks were on the battlefield dead, and they had inlaid, you know, swords inlaid with gold. They had pistols that were fantastic. So the army did quite well. And now Napoleon was in charge of Cairo, right? He had conquered. But his victory wasn't going to last very long. Because let me tell you what happened with the next battle, the Battle of the Nile. Napoleon establishes himself quickly in Cairo. They take over the houses of the Mamluks. Things are going well. And then comes Horatio Nelson, the English admiral. who had been looking for Napoleon's fleet. Now, nobody really knew where Napoleon was going, so they'd been searching around. They heard he had been at Malta. They tried other places. Napoleon had had his fleet anchored at Aboukir Bay. The admiral, Admiral Brie, had suggested, don't anchor here. It's not good protection. Let's take the fleet away to Corfu. They want to go away from Egypt. Bonaparte was an infantryman. Didn't understand having your fleet away from where you need it. He said, no, anchor here. So Brie did a smart thing. He anchored as close to shore as he could so that nobody finding him could go between him and shore. And he pointed all his guns seaward. So if an attack came from the sea, from the Mediterranean, he could fire. 13 ships of the line, they're called. Those were the fighting ships, not the transport ships. There were 13 ships of the line anchored in Aboukir Bay. And Nelson sails into Aboukir Bay and sees him just lined up. Now, Nelson did two things that had never been done in the history of naval warfare. The first thing was, when he sees them, it's about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It's going to get dark fairly soon. And naval battles are not fought at night. At least they weren't then. Normally, you would wait for the next day. Not Nelson. Boom. Sails right in and starts the battle. So you know that the battle is going to be mostly at night. The next thing he does is he sails in between the ships and the shore. Something that was thought impossible. He had no charts of that shore. He had no idea how deep it was. But he told his men, go right in. And they made it. They could do it. So now you've got the ships between the French and the shore. The British are there. All the guns are pointed seaward. And those French ships are sitting ducks. They can't turn the guns. It's not an era when you can turn cannon around very easily. Napoleon's entire fleet was destroyed in one day. Right? The battle went through the night. The largest ship in the history of the world at that point was the L'Orient, Napoleon's flagship. When that ship blew up, it was heard 20 miles away. It's a famous, famous explosion. When the ship blew up, everybody was so shocked that the fighting stopped for 10 minutes. They just kind of didn't believe it. It was at night. It was dark. Also, some of you may remember, some of you may be out there may be old enough to remember a poem that I had to learn when I was a kid. It begins, "The boy stood on the burning deck." That is about a young boy who was the captain's son, Casabianca's son, who when the ship blew up, he refused to leave the ship because his father wasn't there, and he went down with the ship. Right? That's about the Egyptian campaign. So Bonaparte now, his fleet is destroyed. He is stranded in Egypt. Nelson, he's a naval man. He's not a military. He's not an infantry guy. Nelson says, Bonaparte's in a fix that he's not going to get out of. And he simply sailed away, leaving Bonaparte stranded. He couldn't get reinforcements. He couldn't get new supplies. He was in trouble. Didn't faze Bonaparte. What does he do? He founds an institute to study Egypt, right? His fleet is gone. He founds this institute. Now, fortunately, one of the people with him was a guy named Conti. Conti was a guy who could do anything. He was an engineer. And what Bonaparte once said of him was, he has all the arts in his hands and all the science in his head. Now, when the ships went down, they lost a lot of equipment. Surveying equipment, scientific instruments, all kinds of things. Conti could make it. He could recreate almost anything. So Conti helped, and they set up workshops and all that. And the amazing thing is, as this war is going on, the 150 scientists are going about their job of studying Egypt, right? They're drawing plants. They're studying animals. They're uncovering Egypt, right? Now, it's a good thing that they had Conti, because when Bonaparte came into Egypt, there were no places where you could buy things like microscopes, telescopes. They had silk bazaars. That's what they had. So they are doing the best they can. Now, Bonaparte heads out for another battle. He heads out to Acre, which was in Syria then. It's in modern-day Israel. And this is the battle where Napoleon suffers his first real loss, Napoleon himself. Aboukir was a disaster, but it wasn't his baby. Acre was controlled by a man named Djezzar Pasha. Now, Djezzar means the butcher. He was called the butcher because he was not a nice man. I'll give you an example. Djezzar had a physician whose name was Chaim the Jew. And Chaim was asked to examine one of Djezzar's wives to find out if the woman was pregnant, to find out if the wife was going to have a boy or a girl. Now, how is Chaim going to do this? He wasn't even allowed to examine the woman. She would put her hand through a hole in the wall. He would look at her hand, and he had to tell Jezer whether it was a boy or a girl. So Chaim took a guess. Jezer, anxious to find out, had the woman brought and cut open so he could see whether the fetus was a boy or a girl. Chaim guessed wrong and lost an ear, right? And eventually lost an eye. Jezer was not a nice person. Now, Napoleon was going to do battle with Jezer. And it's at the fort of Acre where he loses this battle. Now, understand that Acre is on the water. It's a fort. And the way you normally take a fort is either by starving it out, you camp around it, don't let it get supplies, or you siege it. You charge, make a breach in the wall, and go in. They couldn't starve it out because it's on the water and the British were supplying Jezer Pasha with supplies. So that wouldn't work. So Napoleon had to siege the fort. But he didn't wait for his cannons to come up, and they kept charging the fort. The men would die. It was a terrible, terrible situation for the French army. And not only were they losing the battle because of Jezer Pasha being reinforced and just shooting cannon at him one after the other, the plague had struck. The French started dying of the plague, bubonic plague. So they were really fighting two battles, the military one and this medical one. Now, while this is going on, as I say, the scientists are recording all of Egypt. A remarkable thing. 150 men doing the best they can. Now, by 1798, right, Napoleon knew he was defeated. He marches back from Acre. Marches back. Comes in victorious, by the way. He marches in victoriously into Cairo. They get the healthy ones in front. They march in. They say, yeah, we conquered. Comes in. Always spinning his own legend. Comes in. But Bonaparte knew it was over. It's now 1799, and he's making plans to leave. Bonaparte does not tell his men. He leaves a letter for General Kleber, his next in charge, who says, and it says, by the time you read this, I'll be on a ship heading for Paris. It says, there are the developments in France that call me, I must leave. Kleber is really ticked off. I mean, he's got a losing war. But Bonaparte left with Denon, the artist, and a few other people. And what does he do when he returns? He declares himself a hero. He has medals struck, showing that he is the conqueror of Egypt, right? He's founded an institute, he's come back, and he has medals struck saying, I've conquered Egypt. I mean, it's amazing. The British knew the truth, though, and they had cartoons, wonderful cartoons of Napoleon's scientists studying crocodiles. I mean, there's one great one that shows one of the scientists being bitten by a crocodile, and the book that's fallen out of his arm says, Les droits de crocodile, the rights of crocodiles, right? And they're sort of lampooning that while this war is going on, these guys got their heads in another world. But it was the beginning of modern Egyptology, right? Even though Napoleon is declaring himself a hero returning, and he's not a hero, lots of things are going to happen. First, when they get back, eventually, there's a truce, 1801. The scientists are going to return, and they are going to publish what is probably the greatest publication in the history of the world up till then, the Description de l'Égypte. It's 10 huge volumes of engravings. It's the first time that the West saw Egypt accurately depicted. It's fantastic. It shows the temples. It shows everything. This is the first time that the West is going to realize that pyramids aren't that pointy. You know, always you have people describing things that hadn't even seen it, doing drawings. The Description of Egypt showed it all. Not only that, they brought back collections. These guys were professionals. They were artists. They were engineers who could measure and draw carefully. They brought back collections of antiquities that had never been assembled. It was the first coherent attempt at assembling a collection. I mean, it's remarkable what they did. Now, when the thing was published, the Description of the Egypt was published, it was a sensation. People started a fad, which we call Egyptomania. For example, furniture started to have legs in the shape of mummies, right? Wrapped up mummies. And women used to wear their hairdos. They called it a la Egyptienne, right? And what they felt were Egyptian ways. But it was also important for the zoologists. They had brought back their specimens. Now, it's an amazing story how these guys ever got their specimens back. Think about it. They had lost the war. When the British came in 1801 to work out the treaty, the deal was the following. all antiquities go back to England. Everything the French had collected was British property. That was the treaty. The scientists all said, now these are guys who had spent 2 years under horrible conditions collecting their birds, collecting the plants, collecting everything they wanted. The scientists, the zoologists, the botanists, they all said, we'd rather go back to England with our collections and lose them. They weren't going to let their collections go. Now, the British were really quite decent about it. They said, no, you can take your collections with you. And they let the French go back with their collections. I mean, it was really a rather magnanimous thing. And this became the beginnings of modern collections for museums, when museums would send out expeditions to collect. This is where it all comes from. I mean, think how audacious it was for Bonaparte, going off to fight a war. And what does he do? In addition, he takes 150 scientists and says, oh, we're going to do a scientific study. He was going to colonize Egypt. That was his intention. It was going to become a French colony. So really, from Bonaparte's military campaign, we're starting to see the beginnings, just the beginnings, of modern Egyptology. Now, let me say something about how they made the recordings. As I said before, the ancient Egyptian language was a dead language. Nobody could read it. Nobody. As a matter of fact, nobody even thought that it contained any history, that it might contain records of the kings, that it might contain, you know, annals of military expeditions. Nobody ever thought that. It was always believed to be purely religious. Because think about the name, hieroglyphs, hieros, sacred carvings. Because only the priests could read them in Egypt. That was the literate class. So everybody thought these were just religious texts, right? But Bonaparte had instructed his men, the scientists, some of them were linguists. He had instructed them to copy the hieroglyphs accurately. And there were many men who did nothing but copy hieroglyphs. And they'd done so accurately. I can pick up a page of the Description de l'Egypte. I can pick up a page. And I can look at the hieroglyphs. And I can read them. And they didn't know what they were copying. Right? So it's really quite a remarkable achievement. And that is perhaps one of the most lasting things that Bonaparte achieved. The decipherment of hieroglyphs is going to come right out of this expedition. And let me tell you how. The English said, okay, you can keep the birds, you can keep the plants, but all the antiquities, they're ours. And that included one of the most crucial of all antiquities that Bonaparte's men found, the Rosetta Stone, the famous Rosetta Stone. It was found at a fort in the town of Rosetta, Rashid, as it was called then, found in the town of Rosetta. And it was an interesting finding. It was found by a man named Bouchard, Lieutenant Bouchard. Everybody was looking for the decipherment of hieroglyphs. Everybody knew that maybe this expedition will lead to the decipherment of hieroglyphs. But when they found the Rosetta Stone, they knew immediately that this was going to be the key to decipherment. Why? Because it had the same inscription in two different languages. It had it in Egyptian, but it also had it in Greek. And the Greek inscription said, it's the same inscription twice, right? Actually three times, but I'll talk about that later. So the Rosetta Stone was going to be the key to decipherment of hieroglyphs. Bouchard found it. It was brought to Cairo. The savants looked at it and said, this is going to be the key. The scientists knew this was going to be the key. But the treaty said, all the antiquities have to come to England. The French desperately tried to keep the Rosetta Stone. Desperately. The general who was now in charge, right? Remember, Bonaparte leaves, puts Kléber in charge. Kléber is assassinated soon after. And General Manu is now in charge. And Manu says, this is not part of the government's property. This is my personal property. So therefore, you shouldn't have it. The English simply pointed a cannon at his head and said, we're taking it. And that is why today, the Rosetta Stone is not in the Louvre in Paris. It's in the British Museum in England. Because Napoleon lost that campaign. And the Rosetta Stone was going to be the key. Fortunately, the French had made copies of the Rosetta Stone. They used it. It's inscribed. It's a stone that has carvings. So they used it as a printing stone. They inked it and ran paper over it and pressed it so that they had impressions of it. And scientists are scientists. You know, they're not interested in war. They're not interested in nationality. They passed out copies to everybody who wanted it. So the French had copies of the Rosetta Stone at least. And this is what would lead to the decipherment of hieroglyphs. And it's all because of Napoleon Bonaparte. Now, next time, We're going to talk about the Rosetta Stone and about the actual decipherment of ancient Egyptian. See you next time.